Cooking Issues listeners, if you love Dave, Nastasia, Peter, Kim, me, the whole team, please consider donating to Heritage Radio Network today. We need all the help we can get. HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Click on the beating heart. Make sure you say Cooking Issues in the donation so we can shout you out. And any and all help is very, very greatly appreciated. Enjoy the show.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hey, I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Cooking Issues!
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on the Heritage Radio Network, every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45, joined as usual in the studio with Nastasia and the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
I figured I'd go full crazy today because on the way in, I swallowed a bug and some concrete. That was coffee and hacking.
That's classic.
So you got to go full. Like, when you're not feeling 100%, you got to do, like, 120, and then you come out at, like, 105 or 110. You know what I'm saying? Join in the booth with Jack, the Jackie Molecules. How you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah, calling your questions, too. 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. And if that was too fast for you, the number is 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Joined also in the studio with our favorite subject of abuse, other than ourselves. Peter Kim, the, I don't know, director, president, you know, like head cheese, like the, he's the 601st Wisconsin cheese that's produced, if you listen to the introductory promo
wow.
thing. 600 kinds of cheese in Wisconsin.
Leave it to Dave to diss his sponsors.
Oh, are you saying that you wouldn't make a delicious Wisconsin cheese? Do you know that there are several Peter Kims that are not our Peter Kim? There is
a whole army of us.
There's Being Peter Kim, a blog.
Yeah, there's Peter Kim, Peter Kim.
Who is an actor,
an
right?
An actor, yeah. Then there's all kinds of Dr. Peter Kims.
Lots of doctors.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are your parents now okay with you not being one of those doctors? Boom! Boom! Ouch.
Man.
For those of you that don't know, Peter Kim, not a doctor. lawyer, actually. Quit his lawyering job to start the Museum of Food and Drink. Much to his family's chagrin, but now they're on the side. You've proven that it's good, viable concept.
Yeah, I think they're taking pity on me. So
wow,
yeah,
what a feel good story.
Yeah, it's feel good story of the week. Follow your dreams, get your parents' pity. Okay, Stas, Nastasia Lopez was in Mexico for about 5 hours last weekend.
Revisiting her roots.
Nastasia, yeah. So
putting the Lopez back
in. It's the fatherland, right? Because yeah. It's on her father's side.
Yeah.
Back to Mexico. And Stas, let me see if I get this straight. You flew out Friday morning
yeah.
at like 5 a.m.
6.
Mm-hmm. Right. But how many times did your plane ping pong around like Raiders of the
Once.
Lost Ark style before you made it to
Went
Mexico?
Went to Houston.
Okay. Now, then you left
Sunday morning.
At also like, so you were there for exactly one full day.
36 hours. Some of my friends thought I was getting an abortion.
Whoa.
Wow.
Whoa. Did you remind them you live in New York and you don't have to go to Mexico for that?
They know my salary.
So not.
Oh, we should talk stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So inappropriate on so many levels.
Yeah.
Speaking of bad salary and people who happen to be women, Dax has now watched 9 to 5 twice in 1 week.
Wow.
The classic movie 9 to 5. Lily Tomlin, by the way, freaking amazing. You know, I wish that she was involved in food somehow, Peter, so that we could twist her arm to be involved in the museum somehow. Lily Tomlin is so freaking awesome. I mean, Dolly Parton also freaking awesome. Jane Fonda, you know, fine, good. Anyway, Lily Tomlin. Okay, so why don't you talk to us about the food you had there?
It was okay. There was a lot of, like, sushi.
What?
Hamburgers.
Yeah. Like, regular, like, American interpretations of Japanese sushi?
Yeah.
So, like, it's, like, three times culturally removed?
Yeah, but I found a good carnitas place and some other place, and then I saw a torta stand that said, with pumpkin flowers.
Yeah, the sweet
Florida
calabaza. So I asked
if they could do it with quesadillas, and they said no.
Did you have one of the sandwiches with Florida calabaza?
No, that was not an option either.
Whoa. So what'd they have?
Tortas.
That's a sandwich.
Oh, well, it was not. They weren't.
Hey, good Mexico.
They were pre-made.
The flowers were already done. Well, were they sautéed and then they threw them in the sandwiches?
Sautéed, yeah.
But why didn't you have the sandwich?
I didn't want that.
What, did you think that they said tostada instead of torta?
No.
So why when I said... By the way, people...
Torta is like the little folded up fried thing.
No! Torta is a freaking sandwich. It's a freaking sandwich.
By the way,
Nastasia Lopez, half Mexican chick that grew up in L.A., doesn't know a torta.
Yeah, that's true.
It's also really one of the finest sandwiches out there.
Are we going to go back into sandwiches? Every time Peter comes on, people go into sandwiches. Yes, the tops of the list to me are Cuban...
me too.
Yeah, Cuban.
Yeah.
This is not in order.
Patty melt.
If it's not considered a burger, it's a sandwich, and it's one of the finest. It's one of the finest burgaloids, whatever you want to call the burger genre.
Torta. Banh mi?
Yes, although it's not a single sandwich, because you can have a variety of different banh mis, but yes.
Well, there's a format to it.
Yeah, it's a good format.
Yeah.
What else? Turkey club. BLT.
If done right.
BLT.
Yeah.
BLT to me, superior to a turkey club.
Yeah. Well, and then for me, the egg and cheese sandwich is a classic, too.
Yeah?
Yeah.
The day after Thanksgiving cold turkey sandwich.
That's also a good one. And then Italian cold cut sandwich is also...
Also, not a specific thing. You talking about like Philadelphia style...
I'm talking about like the kind you get around where MoFat is. Like you get, you know, there's like three or four different kinds of...
To me, this is classic, just liking what you love the one you're with.
Wait, did you say Reuben?
Oh, Reuben's
a good
sandwich.
I don't know that it makes the top, though. It's good.
Yeah.
In other words, like, I don't know. There's so many. If we're starting listing sandwiches, pastrami with mustard on rye.
Yeah, it's excellent.
I mean, please.
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah. Exactly.
Standard crappy grilled cheese.
Yep.
Where does PB&J
sandwich? Turkey wrap with alfalfa sprouts.
I'll kill you if you ever mention that again. That is... Were you trying to mention all the poisonous things in one thing? Is there a way to make a flour tortilla without cooking it at all? Because that would be even worse.
Well, I think there are raw tortillas, yeah. They do it... Don't they do it like...
Anyone that would make a raw tortilla wouldn't put turkey in.
Yeah.
But they would have some sort of sprout abomination.
Yeah.
Some sort of hideous sprout.
Italian beef. The chat room says Italian beef. They want to mention.
Well, if we're gonna go hot, which I guess we did. We've gone hot several times.
You have
beef on weck, baby. For any Buffalo people here,
no.
Beef on weck. You know why? They have the kummel buns, the salt and caraway buns, and then the thin sliced beef with the juice.
Mm.
With the juice, yeah.
Yeah.
I think what we're coming to realize is sandwiches are delicious.
Yeah, they are. I've been saying this for years, man.
What do you eat?
Peter, like, you know, people are like, if the bomb was going to drop and you only had 15 minutes, which is like, I can make a sandwich in 15 minutes. He would be eating a sandwich.
I'd kiss my wife, make a sandwich.
Yeah, well, in that order?
Yeah, or simultaneously.
So, yeah, honey, yeah, okay. Enough with the smooching. Sandwiches. What are your thoughts on the muffaletta? Do you appreciate the muffaletta or do you not appreciate the muffaletta?
I like the muffaletta, yeah.
It's very hard to get the bread to meats ratio correct in a muffaletta, I think. Yeah.
Here's a question. Do you like your muffaletta hot or cold?
That's an excellent question. For those of you who don't know, it's the New Orleans sandwich. I like them both, actually. I've had both styles be good. When I was a kid, I didn't used to... So, for tourists, right, it's Central Groceries, like the classic tourist one. I like that now, plain. When I was a kid, I thought it was too much bread, but I'm good with it now. I like them hot. I think whatever it is, Napoleon House, I think, serves them hot. Well, how do you like them, Jack?
Yeah, I go hot usually with that.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I don't love a muffuletta. I'm not like...
Ooh, why? Yeah. You don't like the chopped up jardiniere salad stuff?
Mm. Yeah.
That stuff good.
It's, you know,
I like it.
You don't like that?
I'm in New Orleans. I like it. No, I like having a sour element in...
Shrimp and oyster po' boys all day in New Orleans for
really?
Me. Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm. I don't really like the po' boy bread. I'm going to go on record.
Wow.
Also, po' boy is not really a specific sandwich. It's a whole class of sandwiches.
Yeah, but if you're in New Orleans, like, and you ask for that particular sandwich,
right, yeah.
Then you're getting that. I mean, then it's like that sandwich is what you're like. For that matter, what are your thoughts on all the various Philadelphia cheesesteaky things?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I love cheesesteaks. Yeah.
Why wouldn't you love cheesesteaks? Why wouldn't you? What's wrong with loving a cheesesteak? You're giving me like it's a guilty pleasure. What's wrong with liking a cheesesteak?
No. The only reason I said it with a sigh is because like I feel like now the list is growing and growing. Where we were trying to come up with a tight list of like top sandwiches.
Now we're just saying all sandwiches. Saying,
like, I think from a strictly sense of pure, right?
Yeah,
so
let's
take anything out that's served on a whatever you want to call it, a hoagie roll, a sub roll, whatever. Let's take all those things out for a second.
All right.
Let's remove that crap. That gets rid of your eggplant parms.
Yep.
It gets rid of your meatball subs.
So sliced bread sandwiches only.
Which, by the way, are two things we didn't mention. Yes.
Sliced bread
sandwiches. Let's go on sliced bread.
That also
takes out tortas.
Yeah, yeah.
And takes out, Bergoloids. Patty melts are served on freaking...
sliced bread. Yeah, I know, but like there's
so not grilled. Yeah. So you're saying not like no grilled cheeses. That doesn't count anymore.
Yeah.
You're saying like something served on regular or toasted sliced bread.
Yeah, yeah.
BLT straight.
Yeah, I would go.
That's God's sandwich.
It's got to be the one.
God came down and said, oh, by the way, check this out, BLT.
Yeah.
In season. Tomatoes in season.
Yeah, yeah. Either that or the turkey club, I'd say.
No, turkey club. Well, the best turkey club.
I'm just going to throw this one out there because this is what I have most often at the deli around the corner. I do a grilled cheese with bacon and tomato.
Yeah, it's
good. But you've just grilled the cheese, dude. You just cheated.
Yeah, I know.
Nastasia doesn't like sandwiches because Peter Kim likes them.
Yeah. We ate sandwiches yesterday. They were good.
What's your worst nightmare of a sandwich, Stas?
I don't know.
Biscuit with what?
No.
What do you hate more? A biscuit-based sandwich? We all know you hate biscuits. Or a croissant-based sandwich? Yeah. Not everyone knows Nastasia also hates croissant.
Yeah.
Really?
You know what I hate are catering platter sandwiches.
Oh, yeah.
You just see that platter.
Okay, listen.
That's the worst.
Under lubricated sandwiches.
Yes, under lubrication. There's a rainstorm every time there's a dry sandwich out there, and it's God crying.
I know. It's horrible. That's why I always go for the chicken salad or the tuna salad when I hit the catering sandwich.
Except for what's the problem with all the tuna salad out there? Undersalted!
Yes, no.
Salt your freaking tuna salad. Salt it. Okay. Also, like, I like it when there's some texture in my tuna salad.
So much pain right
like,
now.
I like a little celery in mine.
Me too, man, yeah. I like pickles in mine.
Chicken salad. Oh, my God. Good. Here's the thing. So for catering, first of all, if you're catering, there are always some D-bags out there who don't want salt on there. So you should just put the salt out.
Who's that person?
They're the people ordering catered sandwiches. So what you got to do is you got to, like, put salt out there so that humans can salt it.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, catered sandwiches also do a really poor job of getting, like, filling coverage. So you always get, like, the one-third of the edge of the sandwich is just bread.
You know why?
Like, empty space in between.
It's some jerk. It's some jerk filling the sandwiches with an ice cream scoop.
Exactly.
With a doser.
It's just in the middle. Yeah, yeah.
And the person's like, everyone gets the exact same amount of tuna salad.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, you scoop out, like, that amount of tuna salad, because this person doesn't care. It's like they've never eaten a sandwich. It's either they don't care about you as a human being, or they've never eaten a sandwich before in their life, or some combination of those two. And they just go...
Yeah.
They put that tuna salad scoop right in the middle of that bread, smack the next piece of bread, do the diagonal cut.
Exactly.
Next.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really a horror show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It really is a freaking horror show.
It's the worst.
And also, those things aren't designed to sit around for a long time, so then the moisture migrates into the bread and it turns to a gum. It's either
too
dry or gum.
Unless you do the right architecture.
Well, this is why you need to listen to the British. This is one of the times I'm going to tell you. You need to listen to the British. Tea sandwiches.
Tea sandwiches. Those are the best catered sandwiches, man. When I need to do a picnic... I do tea sandwiches.
Oh, yeah.
I love tea sandwiches.
Of course. This is the classic thing that people do. Even professionals, when they move into catering or people when they order catering, here's a classic mistake people make. What they do is they say, what sandwich would I like to eat if I made it fresh right now?
Right.
And then they make that. That's why you get all those rancid fake buffalo milk and tomato sandwiches at airports on that bread that has that wavy line of like water migration and the top's too dry and it's undersalted and you want to die and you're gumming that thing down and you're waiting to get on an airplane. You know what I'm talking about?
I know.
So rather than that, any like person should think, okay, here's the problem. I'm going to make a sandwich that's going to either sit on a platter for like hours.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to wrap it and it's going to sit for hours. So what do you do? The Brits have that nailed.
Yeah, yeah.
Just make the British, and then like, so what? If an American's like, man, I want a cucumber sandwich, then don't eat. Jerks. All right. Right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm right there with you, man.
How the hell did we get on this? By the way, next week we have on the program, super exciting. So I want you guys to think about questions for the guest we have on next week. We're having on, right? This is confirmed, Stas?
So far.
Yeah. We have Richard Wrangham coming on, esteemed professor at Harvard University, who wrote the book Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. And it's very topical that he's on next week because very recently a letter was published in Nature by two other people at Harvard, Catherine Zink with a K, not like the metal, Zink, and Daniel Lieberman. Daniel Lieberman, well known for writing books about the head, the human head, including his theory that humans have much more wide variety of taste sensations because we're one of the few animals that have retronasal olfaction. That's one of his shticks. Anyway, they came out with an article in Nature saying that Wrangham's hypothesis might not hold water. So briefly put, so that you don't – you should go out and buy his book anyway. It's a very interesting read. You can buy it on audible.com and listen to it on the way to the work, but which is actually what I did. But his basic theory is this, that the human brain takes up a very large amount of energy, right, relative to other primates. How can we afford to have such a kind of a large and sophisticated brain? How can we afford to be the way we are? And he says that if cooking came very early in our split off from being a regular primate to being a human, then the availability of a denser, easier to digest and more efficient caloric intake, right, actually allowed for all of the other developments, evolutionary developments, to take place, so that actually cooking is intertwined with human evolution, and what makes us human, what allowed us to evolve into humans, is our ability to cook foods. That's the, in a nutshell, and it's been months since I've read it / listened to it, but that's his theory in a nutshell. And I think it's super interesting, and I want to have him on, and also to address this new article by Zink and Lieberman, basically saying, look at, you don't need to cook to actually I happen to think that their letter is not accurate. We'll get into it, but you don't necessarily need to cook things in order to get those benefits, that just pounding the ever-loving crap out of them can do that as well. So Wrangham's, his actual thesis is super interesting, and he's done such things as hang out with chimps for months on end, trying to chew chimp food, et cetera, et cetera. Done a lot of interesting stuff, super interesting character. Other things in it you know, in his, one of his prior books is about kind of male-female relations. I haven't read that one yet. Hopefully I'll get to it by next week. So there's lots of interesting sociological things about, like, who did the cooking, how early that split off happened between gender relations as it relates to food. Super interesting. Also, he has some choice words about raw food diets, so I'm sure we'll get into that as well. So please save up some awesome questions for Richard Wrangham on next week's show.
That would make a good exhibit, the museum, too. Interesting topic to explore.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And so the, you know, the real question for a museum exhibit based on this is, I mean, as it's a relatively new theory, you have to present it. I don't know how we do it, but it's super interesting.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's like, what is it that makes us human? It's our language. It's our this. It's our that. He's like, it's our cooking. Mm-hmm. But what I like about his argument is the style of presentation is, look it. If you just use Occam's razor, like, what's the simplest way to figure out? Like, we all know we have cooking now, right? It's very difficult to figure out exactly when cooking happened from the record, from the archaeological record. But he said Occam's razor shows that the simplest explanation for how we got to where we are is cooking. And so, like, any other explanation is actually more convoluted. And so until someone comes out with a simpler explanation that fits the data or finds data that contravenes this theory, this is the theory you should work with. Mm. And I like that kind of – that's my mode of thinking.
Before Peter has to leave, Let's talk to him about his stuff.
Oh, no.
What's, there's a call. You want to speak that in first?
Oh, let's do the call. Caller, you're on the air.
Dave, this is Jeffrey in Costa Mesa. How's it going?
All right. How you doing?
Doing well. I recently mentioned your book, Liquid Intelligence, to an associate, not a friend. Not a friend.
Okay.
The person's a bartender. And his response was, oh, it's too science-y for me. Mm. What? And it reminded me of the reviews that you read on Amazon years ago. Just metal-headed fools. And here's the thing. Even if I, God forbid, never have access to a rotary evaporator, I still benefit from understanding what vacuum and distillation can achieve, what kind of flavor retention you can get. If I never have access to, or if I don't have access to a centrifuge, yes, Dave.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I get your point. We're coming as soon as we can. I can't get the centrifuge. I have to make it good enough for release. That's the thing. Nastasia, vouch for the fact that we're working hard on it.
Working hard.
All right, go ahead.
That's about. Yeah. We can wait. Yeah. But yeah, so even though I don't have a centrifuge, I still benefit from understanding the various clarification techniques and what you can do on different products. So the book is useful no matter whether you have access to all of the equipment or not, because it makes you a better cook.
I hope so.
This bartender probably still can't even make a proper and consistent Manhattan because they think that you can chill a drink harder with large ice cubes without simultaneously diluting because they don't know the fundamental law of cocktail. Jerk.
Well, okay, let me ask you this. Is your associate... Here's the thing. You can be wrong... You can be very, very wrong and still make good drinks as long as your actual – a lot of times people's practice doesn't jibe with their mental representation of what they're doing. Is this right. person's drinks – are they good?
They're okay, but they're not consistent.
Yeah, of course. Okay. Yeah. I mean, like, here's the
thing. But it's more – I mean, whether they can make a good drink or not, it's more just sort of like skimming the book and then deciding – whatever those reviews were, like too much information that just doesn't even make sense.
I know, but look, I have a very particular attitude, and sounds like you also have a very particular attitude. Some people just don't respond well to like analytical thinking. You know what I mean? They just don't. They just don't respond.
Right.
So it's not for
just the
not
section on just the section on apples is worth the sticker price, and that's not as analytical. You know, it's just a more interesting read. So. Anyway, people should buy the book.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And tell your friend very gently, just be like, your drinks are good. I'm not saying that you have to do all sciencey stuff, but maybe you could work on the consistency. Maybe.
Yeah. Gentleness is key when interacting.
Yeah, unless he's going to go full Japanese, in which case it's like you don't want it consistent. Every drink should be like a journey from beginning to end. A drink should take 10 to 15 minutes to complete. You know, it should cost $30. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. There's that whole genre as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, my question is about cocktails. I plan to, for my future sister-in-law's bridal shower, I plan to force carbonate a French 75 and bottle it. So I've done this in the past just by clarifying lemon, chilling down gin and water, sort of carbonating that, and then just popping the bottle of champagne.
Right.
Does Nastasia like a French 75, or is that just ruining champagne with gin?
She's not a huge gin fan. Stas, why don't you...
Yeah, I don't like it.
No, not good. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So my question is, pouring twice into those little 187-mil bottles is just kind of a pain, and I'm wondering if there's a wine that could reasonably approach a champagne-type note if carbonated at a lower PSI.
Hmm.
You know, if I could just do the whole thing, dilute it, chill it down, and carbonate... I don't even know what pressure champagne usually likes to sit at.
High, but remember, once you turn it into a French 75, it's got... So the classic French 75 is not very carbonated at all because it's just champagne added to the drink. So I
diluted it further than I normally would if I was just shaking, and I went up to like 60% water for that original base.
Yeah, I have to do some. I don't have my numbers. I'd have to do some calculation. I once did some work. In fact, I was going to have a sidebar in the book on French 75s, but I never did it. And I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head. I mean, champagne is obviously a very good carbonated wine, and it's going to add its own kind of yeasty notes to it. But you could use it. I mean, yeah, you could use anything. I mean, I would use something that doesn't – that you just have to test it. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't use anything that didn't – that tasted, you know, wildly different. You want to do it for – you don't want to do – you don't want to re – you don't want to use champagne because of the price?
No. I'm just wondering if just pouring into those little bottles, because I'm going to make a bunch of these, is just a pain, and then I have to do it twice because I'm force carbonating the gin mixture.
Don't do that. Don't do that. Just dump the entire whatever wine you use. Just dump the entire mixture together. Throw it in the freezer.
Losing too much gas that way, though, just by pouring it all out. It all kind of foams. You know, you can't eliminate all of the nucleation sites.
But you're going to recarbonate it. Right? So the actual...
Oh, so hit the whole thing, recarbonate it then with the original champagne?
Yeah. Whenever I do this stuff, I batch everything, including the stuff that's, like, originally carbonated. That original carbonation, that foaming that happens, actually helps to kind of get some of the other gases and crap out of your mixture. Then you take that whole thing. Now you can taste it to make sure it's completely homogeneous. Chill it down until it's almost frozen. And then just recarb the whole thing and pour it into bottles. Much easier and much more consistent.
So, but then when you did mention price when you're buying champagne, are you paying for the bubbles at all? Is that going to...
Well, it's just a different... You're paying... When you're buying for champagne, you're paying for A, you're paying for the fact that it's champagne. You're paying for the amount of time it takes, the process it goes through. Right, so they're typically relatively acidic grapes.
Right.
They have to go through like the long process. They get disgorged and then you know dosage and all this other stuff. So you're going through a big rigmarole to produce. But I'm sure you can make a delicious French, 74 or 76 with a different sparkling
cheaper
wine.
Cheaper prosecco and lower the sugar or something that tasty.
Yeah, I mean a prosecco cava or even like maybe a Cremant might be nice. I mean like I would just get like a bottle. Look, it's not a hard as long as you're getting something that you like drinking. It's not a hardship to open a bottle, make 175 with it, feel how you feel about it, and then drink the rest as bubbles. Right? Especially if you're going to make a bunch. And then once you lock it down, then now you have something in your pocket that you can do inexpensively. Like I used, I don't use it anymore, but like when I got married, because it was 22 years ago, we went on a side-by, we tasted like a billion cavas side-by-side, and I stuck with that cheap cava for like 15 years. Do you know what I'm saying? I think it's kind of gone downhill, so I'm not going to recommend it. But you know what I'm saying? Like once you get a good thing in your pocket, then it's there for a long time.
Then it happens to go.
Yeah.
And what pressure range would you try at least at first?
45. 45 PS. 45 at.
4 or 5. Okay.
Yeah, 4 or 5.
Last the fruit out.
No. That's what typically – it depends on what your alcohol content is. If you're getting your alcohol content down to like between 13 and 15% on your final batch,
that's what I'll aim for.
Then 45 PSI at cold temperature is going to be good.
All right. I'll give it a try.
All righty. Let us know how it goes.
Take it.
All right. Cool.
Okay.
All right. Here's some stuff in. Wait, what were we going to talk about with Peter again? Oh,
yeah, Peter's back.
Are you staying for the rest of the time?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so let me get some stuff written in, and then we'll talk about Peter's. We'll talk about.
Oh God.
Have you ever heard of the?
I want to hear this now.
The House Guest Olympics. It's something that my wife and I, Jen, we used to do. It's called the House Guest Olympics. Nobody knew they were participating in the House Guest Olympics. But we would rate people after they came based on like how good of a house guest or how bad of a house guest they were.
Well, this changes every time I come over to your place now.
Yeah. How bad was I?
House guests have to sleep over, by the way.
Oh, okay.
How bad am I?
You're fine, Stas. You're fine. But I can't rate you on the house guest. You're basically like, you know, almost like a family member at this point.
Still,
so it doesn't count.
Yeah.
But you know, we've known each other for how many? That's not true. I've rated people that I've known for like over a decade.
Oh my God.
But it's a question of like how
Stas, you've been rated.
I left snacks.
Snacks is good. No, but also it's like House Guest Olympics is most normally when they're staying there when you're there.
Okay.
So it's how they interact with you.
Okay.
So if someone shows up at your house, right, and then is like, and I don't want to be a bother. I don't want to be a bother. So they bring like their own like milk and stuff. That's weird. Like
that knocks you down
in the House Guest Olympics. When people like leave crap in your bathroom, House Guest Olympics way down.
Whoa.
When someone like Nastasia like leaves wine and snacks in the thing, that's very good on the House Guest Olympics.
Yeah.
When I thought that she blew up our fireworks, that knocked her down a couple of pegs.
Oh, wow.
But the fireworks, they were found.
Yeah.
So like yes. So the fire, so that knocks her back up on the House Guest Olympics. And plus, when you came with Mark, you guys brought tons of awesome Italian products. So you're doing quite well in the House Guest Olympics.
Wow.
So, but anyway, so Peter has some House Guest Olympics stuff going on that we'll talk about after we get some questions.
I don't want to get into it. She doesn't listen to the show, Peter.
This is from, well, we assume not. This is from Mark Powie in the District of Columbia. Dave mentioned that he wanted to investigate the contents of cooked versus rotovapped maple syrup. I did say that. Sap, actually, maple sap. So the theory being that if you're doing it at low temperature, that you're not going to have the same flavor. There's already some work in this area, but with more of a focus on human health than on deliciousness, of course. See Navindra Serum's work at the University of Rhode Island. Cooking the sap does, in fact, result in new process-derived molecules, like a polyphenol named Quebecol, like Quebec. Why do they name it after?
It has a weird voice.
Hey, Dave, what's the...
Quebecol.
What's the Alex Trebek's...
Quebecois.
What's his nationality? What did you want to make?
Trebecois, yeah. His own nationality. And if you're a Trebecois, you not only pronounce French in a weird way, no offense, Quebecois folks, but you also try to pronounce everyone else's language like Alex Trebek does. So that's what it takes.
Right.
Do you like Alex Trebek, Peter?
No.
What are your feelings, Jack, on Alex Trebek?
Neutral. I don't know. What's with the no? Why? Like, what's wrong with Alex Trebek?
I don't know, man.
You know what it is? It's seeing him in Taxis that pisses me off.
Before
I was like, oh, Alex Trebek, he's an intellectual guy. He's intellectually curious. You know, he seems to be a good arbiter of the truth. And then you see him in the Taxi and you realize he's just another, like, shill.
Well, he became really self-aware and got all kind of like a parody of himself.
When I was with my grandma, we used to sit and we would watch Wheel of Fortune with Pat Sajak and Vanna White, and then Jeopardy with the Alex Trebek.
Oh, yeah, same.
I was a huge fan.
Yep.
And then, like, you know, just after a while, like, him, like, pronouncing all the Spanish words with that freaking lisp, even if this person was freaking Mexican or from South America, I'm like, you know what I mean?
Oh, right, yeah.
That's a big pet peeve of mine.
Like, what?
Maybe that's where he learned Spanish.
Like, listen, like...
It's a regional lisp. Come on.
Yeah, what the hell? If it's a Spanish person, fine. If you're going to pronounce someone...
What if he learned his Spanish in Spain?
From, like, Ecuador, from, like, Colombia, from Mexico, then you don't pronounce Spanish that way. Just pronounce it like an American or a Canadian then. You know what I'm saying? If you're going to mutilate... If you're not going to do it like the person who would if they were alive, right?
But that's where he learned to speak Spanish, was Spain.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, really? I didn't realize he was a Spanish professor in Spain.
Yeah.
I was wrong. Here's another thing. Also, like how he, like, he's like, oh, no, the answer was blah. Like, yeah. Or the question was blah. Of course he knows. He has the answer in front of him on a card.
What I'm to say.
I don't know, man. Trebek.
Yeah.
Trebekois.
Yeah.
Anyway. A polyphenol named Quebecol. Given that there are amino acids and a lot of sugar in the sap, I expect some Maillard products as well. I wonder if any volatile components can be pulled off and collected from maple syrup. I think I've tried. It's hard. I mean, like, there is a volatile note to it, obviously, but I can't... I think I've tried distilling syrup, but I don't... I can't remember whether I got good results or not. I don't think I did. I don't remember. I also wonder about separating some of the flavorants from the sugars. I'm thinking of trying a recrystallization from ethanol. Mark Powie. Man. And then he links to some of the papers. I can't access the full articles, but you know, it's on University of Rhode Island's website. But that's super interesting. Thanks for writing that in. And hopefully if you do anything interesting with it, you'll write back and tell us more. I'm interested. Were we ever going to get some maple sap and do a demo at the museum, Peter?
No, I don't remember. I don't think so.
Maybe we should.
That'd be great.
Maybe we should.
Yeah, sure.
A little late in the season.
Yeah.
Do you know that NPR did an April Fool's joke a long time back saying that trees were exploding because people weren't tapping them, and if you don't tap the maple trees that they would explode. They did it and people actually believed it. It's pretty hilarious.
The best NPR April Fool's joke was when they did the headline was studies show that nobody reads headlines and not the actual article. And then there was like thousands of comments of people like, you jerks, I read the article, of course I do. And then the body of the article is
This is an April Fool's joke. That's awesome. Meta. I have a good April Fool's joke, the best one I ever did. If we have time at the end of the show, you can have me tell it because it is our April Fool's. It's not food
related.
Tomorrow
is Dave's birthday.
Tomorrow is my birthday.
How old are you going to be?
45. Hey, it's Jeremy from Seattle. Hope all is well on your... What?
But
hope all is well on your side of the world. I have a quick question for the show, finally. I brined and water bathed a 3-pound... This is late, by the way, because obviously this is no longer relevant to Jeremy. But I brined and water bathed a 3-pound pork loin at 145 Fahrenheit for 3.5 hours last night. Someone get me that number in Celsius, please. I pulled it out, dried it, and seared it. After ate a few slices at about 9:30 p.m., all right? Popped it back in the bag, displacement sealed it, and tossed it into an ice bath. So he didn't really do a vacuum on it, so it's probably, you know, not 100% oxygen-free. Then I promptly passed out on the couch. I am familiar with this problem. Woke up about 12:30 a.m., and having completely forgotten about the pork, crawled upstairs and got ready for bed. Got up around 5:30 and remembered, pork. And ran down and checked the water temp. It was 61 degrees Fahrenheit, so I threw it in the fridge to chill, hoping it's okay to eat tonight or tomorrow. Any suggestions or warnings?
You may be dead. How old is this question?
That's from last week. So if you're alive, Jeremy, I would eat it. Like, I would just reheat it. You're probably... Look, you killed all of the aerobic stuff. I don't think... you know, I'm not an expert in this. I didn't have time to look it up too much. I don't think there's a lot of spore-forming aerobic bacteria. I don't think you made an anaerobic enough environment to cause the spores to germinate during that period of time. And anything you did, you could just do a quick kill on the outside. Remember, you cooked it and totally killed everything. Then you seared it. Then you put it back in a bag. So to me, it's like similar to like a deli meat that's been sitting out, even though it wasn't cured. It was brine, too. So it was salted on the outside. So my feeling is that if you ate it, you're probably safe. And if you didn't eat it, you probably would have been safe, especially with a light sear to make the family less queasy and nervous about it.
There's a slight chance that you're wrong, you'll just die.
You could be dead.
Though the thing is like I always use the same thing. Would I feed it to my family or not? Yes. Bang. You know what I mean? That way you can't say, Dave says it's safe. I'm just saying, what would I do? Just in a similar way to what would Brian Boitano do. Ben wrote in about salmon. I have a question about lox / smoked salmon. I love the stuff, and I'm happy to patronize its local purveyors. Patronize is a weird term because it's either very good or very bad.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I don't know.
Yeah. Local purveyors, that's patronizing.
Oh, look at your little lox.
Anyway, no, patronize. Give them money. Very good. See what I mean?
Yeah.
Could go either way.
Yeah.
Shout out to Shelsky's and Russ and Daughters. You been to Shelsky's yet?
Nope.
I haven't either. Russ and Daughters. I have to go I hear it's good. I have to go I go to Russ and Daughters probably once a week because Booker and Dax force me to go. I mean, I would go anyway, but they force me to go. Anyway,
Trout caviar is on the Dave Bingo game that Nastassi and I play.
What's that?
Well, there's stories that you bring up here and there. So if we,
I didn't even mention it. You mentioned it.
I know.
See how you self perpetuate things.
That wasn't the bingo. We know that.
I know. But I'm just saying you were about to go there.
I wasn't.
Yeah. I would very much like to see the bingo board.
There's no bingo board. It's in our heads.
Yeah.
Okay. And they add to it whenever Nastassi is the queen of this. I knew you were going to say that. Well, then why didn't you say it beforehand so you could prove it? Why didn't you write it on a piece of paper, fold it in half, and hand it to me after I said it?
Yeah.
See, that would be amazing Randy move.
Right, that's magic. Let's build an actual board.
No, it's because they can't put their freaking money where their mouth is because they're jokers.
We can.
Jokers.
That, by the way, is also a bingo item.
Yeah. Jokers? Jokers? Jack, when was the last time you heard me call someone a joker?
I've never heard you say the word joker.
Boom.
Putting us down is definitely on the bingo board.
No, that's just because it needs to happen. That's not a bingo. That's like saying, oh, Dave, do you need to breathe? Yeah, or you die. You know what I mean? Okay.
Caller on the line. Also on the bingo board.
All right, caller, we'll get back to your salmon question. Caller, you're on the air.
Okay, yeah, I hope your retina has not detached, but I'll quickly get to my question. I had a curious idea. You know, they have that debate in barbecue where some people cook things hot and fast and some people cook things low and slow.
Right.
Is what do you think of that, number one? And the other question is, how does that relate to regular braising? Like, some people like to braise stuff at, like, a 350-degree temperature, and some people like to braise stuff at, like, a, you know, a 280-degree temperature. Is there really that big of a difference, and what do you think?
Here's the thing. To me, when it comes to barbecuing, hot and fast is really just, like, some variant of grilling. You know what I mean? So it's just going to be different. You're not going to get like what you consider barbecue from a pit standpoint is like you have to do a lot of tissue breakdown, and that just doesn't happen quickly. You know what I mean? That happens.
I know.
Yeah.
There's just so many people that do that. Like, not, you know, garbage web blogger people, like major people that do that, and they don't think it matters.
Like, how fast?
Yeah, like, I mean, like Ed Mitchell cooks at like 350 degrees.
But like open or like wrapped and closed?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, for a temperature, for a time of, you know, 4 hours or whatever, but it's a locked and closed. Him and several other big barbecue guys, they cook stuff at like plus 300 degrees.
They're also doing he's doing whole hog, right? Ed Mitchell's doing whole hog?
Whole hog, but I've seen him do other things like the same exact way.
Smaller stuff?
Yeah, like ribs or something like that.
Mm. I mean, the bigger something is.
It was like if we were going to braise something in a liquid, you could get the 350 degrees, you know, for that amount of time, and they seem to be kind of doing that same temperature on a smoker.
Right. Look. So let's look at it this way. Let's go to braising first. If you're braising, and remember, like, you know, if you like Ed Mitchell's product, then obviously they're doing something right, whether or not it fits with kind of what we theoretically think, right? If you like their product, then they make a good product, and so you have to investigate what they do to figure out, like, why it works the way it does. I'm just going to say that off the top. Now, when you go to braising and you're looking at a braising phenomenon, the biggest difference in a braise is whether or not the lid's off or lid's on, right? So
sure.
if your lid is on, then the braise is getting up to 212, right? You're not really building any pressure. Anyone who says that you're building pressure, it's nonsense. It's horse crap. You know what I mean? Unless it's in a pressure cooker. Because even a very slight overpressure on the order of, you know, decimal PSI is enough physical force to make the lid fly off of anything that you would have on there, right? So that whole thing about, like, pressurizing it that people used to say, like, put aluminum foil and then push it down and you form a pressure. No. Crap. You know what I mean? But you are getting it up to 212 or higher, actually, depending on how – not much higher, but higher, depending on how thick the goop is that you have the thing braising in.
Sure.
With the lid off, you're getting evaporative cooling, and so the temperature is significantly lower, like, you know, somewhere probably in the, you know, high 80s or 90s, right, Celsius. McGee knows the exact answer because he's done these things, but so with the lid off, as long as you keep the liquid level right, I don't know that you're going to have that much of a difference whether your oven is above 212 or not. It's just going to – you'll probably increase the evaporation rate if you have a higher oven, but you're not probably going to materially affect what you're doing. Now, when it comes – now, let's transfer this over to barbecue land now. So let's say you're doing – let's say you're doing something at like 350, right? So what's the difference to the meat at the very inside of a whole hog when you're doing 350? Answer, not a whole hell of a lot, right? Because still locally where you are in the meat, assuming that you're a tiny trichinosis worm on the inside of a piece of pork, right?
Exactly.
Right. If you're in there, you are never going to get above 212 ever. You know what I'm saying? Until all of your moisture is out and the temperature then can rise above the boiling point of water. So a high temperature on what would typically be a braising cut or something that's going to cook for a long period of time is just going to affect the amount of meat that can be desiccated on the outside, right?
Yeah.
And so what I would assume that he would get would be a much higher portion of of desiccated, dried out, overcooked crunchy bits. And maybe he likes that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I'm saying? That's why I asked, on smaller cuts of meat, it would seem to be a lot more detrimental, because you could dry out a significant portion of it before the inside is tender enough for your you know, hopes and desires. Does that make sense?
I would think so. Yeah, I just remember, you know, on the braising side, I remember reading, you know, like in the French Laundry cookbook where they talked about braising everything under 300 degrees because they thought it was more gentler. But if your water temperature is never getting over a significant thing, it doesn't seem to matter.
I don't think it matters much. You know, next time we get McGee on, see if you can like he loves to talk about this stuff, so we can we'll have that debate. I'm sure he'll go on a tear as much as McGee goes on a tear, which is not, you know, he's not like a,
we don't know,
he's not like a rant. Well, he doesn't rant in public much.
It does seem to take longer when you braise things in liquid at a lower temperature. And versus at a 350.
Even small changes in temperature affect by a bit how long it takes collagen to break down.
And that's what I'm really wondering about. Is it more of a collagen thing or a, you know?
Yeah, collagen breakdown. But the difference in the texture of a protein at, you know, 85 Celsius and at 100 is, like, you know, it's the freaking same. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
it's overcooked. You know what I mean? Well, that's why you have to have other flavors or things or a lot of collagen to break down. And one of the reasons why I am not the biggest fan of whole hog, because then stuff – you're doing that rancid overcooking to stuff like the loin. Now what? You know what I mean? It's like – you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't know why people like it. But
because they hack the whole freaking thing up, and you have some stuff that tastes really good and some stuff that's overcooked, and so you average it out to being something that's good. But, in my book, why not, like, cook the loin exactly the way you want it, then cook all the, like, the low and slow stuff the way you want it, hack it up, and have it all be better. Right, Peter?
Well, there's the ceremony to it, right? I mean, it's the reason why we do whole turkeys for Thanksgiving.
There's a ceremony to it.
Well, that's why you want to do...
Yeah.
You like to do a whole
turkey. You're right, okay.
Oh, my God.
The high-pitched voices of bingo thing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can we get to Peter's story?
No, there's no
story. Yes. All right.
Yeah, we have to, because we're wrapping up.
Well, hold on a second. I got to finish the salmon question. Justino, hold on a second. All right. So I'm happy to patronize local purveyors. Shout out to Shelsky's and Russ and Daughters. But I was wondering if it was worth making this stuff at home. I would also be curious to hear the Cooking Issues team thoughts on the product. We all like smoked salmon, yeah, right? Lox. And by the
way,
in my world, lox is lox, i.e. not smoked. Salt and sugar cured either wet or dry, and then, you know, allowed to dry off a little bit and sliced. To me, that's lox, right? And the smoked salmon, like Nova style, Gaspel, all that stuff, smoked salmon. Okay? Bump, bump. And we're talking cold smoked salmon here, not hot smoked. All right? We're all on the same page?
Mm.
Okay. I think basically I need a primer, but here are my questions. Any thoughts on reliable books / recipes, especially for traditional Jewish appetizing styles, i.e. Nova Lox, Belly Lox, etc.? Thoughts on the curing step, dry versus wet, and equipment? I have a backyard and a Weber charcoal grill, but I assume I'll need to invest some sort of cold smoking rig. Yes. Do you have any recommendations on makes, styles, etc.? Are there any that do double duty as a hot smoker that are worthwhile? How about wood? Thoughts on the species, pellets versus chips, others, etc.? And fish. How high a grade do I need to go? Should I be looking for the stuff I'd make sashimi with, or is my usual pricey NYC supermarket salmon okay? Thanks in advance. Been a listener since day one, and the show has seriously helped me up my cooking, eating, mixing, and drinking game. Ben. Okay, first of all, let's start on salmon, because we're gonna run out of time here, and we got to get a Peter's thing. So if we start on salmon, definitely salmon's going to make a huge freaking difference in this, and you're going to want to choose what you want based on the fat variety. So I would go to Russ and Daughters and I would ask them what kind of salmon things are made out of. So for your first choice is Atlantic salmon versus Pacific salmon. And then if you're going to go either of those, you really should either buy stuff that's sushi grade, which has been frozen, or you should freeze it hard in your freezer for over a week to kill any worms, Anisakis worms or tapeworms that are in it, because the curing step may not kill it, especially a cold smoke step. But investigate this. So Chinook obviously has the highest fat content, king salmon. So if you want a very high fat content, and this is like the salmon that you would get from New Zealand king salmon or a gold, like that's the stuff that they make the New Zealand Zealand king salmon that you get at Russ and Daughters. I think that stuff's fantastic. It's super high in fat. It's got a very nice texture because it's been anesthetized before they kill it, so it stays very firm. So over, you know that stuff is – he's good. I think the salmon's going to make a huge difference. I also called up Nils Norin to get his regular gravadlax recipe. And, oh, my God, I can't – oh, here it is. I'm trying to find it. I wrote it down, but I guess it didn't get pasted in. Should I do that next week? Should I talk
yeah,
about
– yeah.
I'll talk about Nils' salmon Peter. Recipe next week. And versus cold smoking, like I'm sure other people have a lot more experience with different cold smokers. Typically, it's done with like pipes and ice over the things to make it done. But the people on the internets will help us out, and we'll talk about it more next week. So Ben, we're going to get back to your question more next week. Peter, Nastassi, why don't you go? Why don't you say what the story is?
Peter had a terrible house guest.
All right, that terrible house guest. What did they do, Fine. Peter? First of all, there was an Airbnb person. Peter had an Airbnb person come over. So, and they stayed there. They are a med school student, and they drank all of his liquor.
Yeah.
Without saying what? Anything. They drank all of his freaking liquor.
Including,
and I don't know why you had a bottle of this, a whole bottle of Malibu.
Look, there are things that people bring over who are low on the house guest Olympics.
Yeah. So this lady was doing you a favor.
Those things yeah. sit in the bar.
So this lady
Maybe
was doing you a favor.
That particular guest, case.
And she had bottles, Magnum bottles of Yellowtail lying around,
Worse.
Empty, lying
Worse
around her room in the Airbnb thing, and she never had house guests over. This right. is some nice. And
or it's yeah. Harold McGee.
Yeah,
it's,
she blamed Harold McGee because Harold McGee did stay there once. All
wow.
right, so listen, on the way out, I'll tell you quickly my April Fool's joke. That we did. So this was in 1990. This was before we had anyone. We had one guy on the floor. This is in college. My freshman year had a laser printer. He was a senior. No one had a laser printer. Laser printer, right? So what we did for April Fool's Day is all the freshmen lived in specific entryways in our college dorm. And we wrote a letter, and I can still remember it to this day. We faked Yale Stationery, which is where I went to college. We faked Yale Stationery, faked everything, and printed this letter out and gave it to every single freshman. Due to the unusually high number of matriculating transfer students, we will not be able to offer a place in the sophomore class to all of our current freshmen. Please find below an application for sophomore standing to be filled out and handed in to your RA by the end of the week.
Wow.
And we folded it up along with an application and put it in everyone's cubbyhole on like laser printed. And our fake stationery looked better than Yale's real stationery at the time. We got the linen paper. We got everything. People flipped out, and all of the freshman counselors, right, played along. They all played along, oh, and we didn't even talk to them
That's
about
cruel.
It. They just all played along, and we like had people flipping the hell out. And that is the roughest April Fool's joke that I've ever been involved in playing on somebody.
Wow,
cooking issues.
Happy birthday.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.